And then when the CD came out and I went to the first demonstration of CD in LA and heard the first CD, and it was horrible. The sound was just everything I ever hated about bad sound. But everybody said, oh, it's the best thing I ever heard. And that's when I knew I had a mission in life, which was to promote records and to tell the truth that whatever this format might become, because it was brand new and it would get better over time, that what's coming out right now sounds terrible. And that cannot be allowed to become the standard of what good sound is. It's not even digital. You know, a CD is not really digital. It's an analog of digital. So it's a physical representation of the bits. You know, it's not the bits themselves. It's the land and the divots in the disc. This is an analog of digital. It's like the stupidest system ever. I mean, it's genius, but it's stupid.
Para a maioria dos audiófilos, o convidado deste episódio do podcast Música e Som não precisa de apresentações. Especialmente para aqueles que recorrem ao formato em vinil para ouvir música. Mas o editor da Tracking Angle e da The Absolute Sound já fez muitas outras coisas. Michael Fremer já foi apresentador de rádio, deu voz a personagens em filmes de animação, supervisionou a banda sonora do filme Tron de 1982 e foi editor na revista de referência de alta fidelidade Stereophile. Recentemente, o jornalista de áudio de longa data também se aventurou na produção pontual de edições muito limitadas de discos de alguns artistas que decide apoiar.
Este episódio tem o patrocínio de Haja Som, a criar sistemas de música desde 1986. Aconselhamento na seleção dos equipamentos e na otimização dos sistemas. Giradiscos, streamers, amplificadores, colunas e acessórios das melhores marcas. Visite-nos em hajasom.net.
So, Michael, nowadays many people know you for your reviews of turntables and vinyl reproduction audio gear, but you had another life before that. Can you resume what you did before writing about hi-fi equipment, please?
Sure. And I still have that other life. You know, this isn't all that I do. It's a lot of what I do, but it's not all of it. So, you know, I mean, I don't know where you want to start. Let's start when I went to college. And I immediately went to the radio station and got a job on the radio station at the college, because I always wanted to do that. And I got fired from that for reading off, at that point in time, news was over a ticker tape. You know, it showed up on a teletype machine and you ripped off a piece of paper and you read the news. And that's what I did. But I read something that came from United Press International, which is one of the big news services of the time. And the thing I read had a double meaning of what it might mean, which I won't repeat to you. I don't know how vulgar you want to get, but it wasn't vulgar in and of itself, but it had a double meaning that was hilarious. And I laughed at it and I got fired for that. But, you know, everybody that was listening laughed also because it was funny. So that was not a good start. So then I graduated college and I was going to be a veterinarian, but I didn't do too well in organic chemistry, so I switched to industrial and labor relations, and that's what I got my degree in. And then I went to law school in Boston, and of course, the first thing I did was go to one of the local record stores and get a job at the record store so I could get my records at a discount. And then pretty quickly, I started doing the radio commercials for the record store, and those started becoming really infamous. And so I started making decent money at that and becoming pretty well known in Boston, and I enjoyed the notoriety, to tell you the truth. And so I dropped out of law school, which was the best thing I ever did, because I really didn't want to be a lawyer. And then I started doing commercials for a bunch of other places, a bigger record store and then for a stereo store. And those commercials, I still get emails from people today. They find my name. They don't know anything about high-end audio. They just remember what I did in 1970 four or whatever it was, and they ask, do you have a copy of that commercial where you said blank? It's really fascinating. So I send them a copy of the commercial, and then I was on the radio in Boston on WBCN, which was like the big progressive rock station at the time, and I got fired from there also. I got fired for doing a satire of, it was the first International Women's Day. And so it was a whole day of women's programming, which was great. I was all in favor of that. But my show was the all night slot, and everybody expected me to do something about some sort of parody or satire on International Women's Day. And the program director said to me, don't touch it, don't go near it. But I had to touch it, I had to go near it. So I got on the air, and the first thing I said was, welcome to the men's room. We'll play men's music, Herbie Mann, Manfred Mann, you know, Mandrake Memorial, Johnny Mann Singers. And I thought that was kind of low-key satire that, you know, we had the men's shaving hotline where you could learn how to grow that little funny thing that Greg Allman had under his lip. And, yeah. You know, mild satire, nothing satirizing the women's movement or anything. But I got fired for that, too. So glad I did it. I don't regret a thing. So then I came back to do commercials for the same station and to do political satire for the station. So I was always on the radio. And then I'll make this as quick as I can. So then some guys in Boston were producing a movie, and they loved my voices. So they called me in and said, it's an animated film. Do you want to do some voices and help us finish writing the film? Which I did. I finished writing it, and they loved my voices, and they loved all the names I made up. And then they invited me to move to LA to help finish the movie. So I did that. And the movie is called Animal Olympics. I don't know whether you have ever heard of that, but the voices on it were,
I Googled you, and one of the results that came back was an entry from IMDb, the Internet Movie Database, and it says that you also participate in the 1982 Tron film.
Which film?
In
Tron.
Tron, I supervised the soundtrack to Tron. Yeah, I was going to get to that in a second.
Yeah.
So Animal Olympics, the voices were Gilda Radner, Billy Crystal, Harry Shearer, and me. Now, they've all drifted off into obscurity, and I'm a big star.
Yeah.
That movie, that was a fun movie. It's still running, and people still like it. And the people that liked it in 1980 when it came out, now show it to their grandchildren. And, you know, and Graham Gouldman from 10cc did the music, and I hired him to do that. And, So that was a cool thing. And then I supervised the soundtrack to Tron, which was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Soundtrack. You know, we lost to E.T., but that was expected. And then I started doing a bunch of other things. And eventually, all this time, I was writing for local magazines about music and sound. And then when the CD came out, and I went to the first demonstration of CD in L.A. at the Audio Engineering Society and heard the first CD, and it was horrible. The sound was just everything I ever hated about bad sound. But everybody said, oh, it's the best thing I ever heard. And that's when I knew I had a mission in life, which was to promote records and to tell the truth that whatever this format might become, because it was brand new and it would get better over time, that what's coming out right now sounds terrible. And that cannot be allowed to become the standard of what good sound is. So that's how I got started in all of this. And I started writing magazine articles and agitating and making bumper stickers saying compact discs sound terrible, and going to these meetings and standing up. And they had hired a bunch of audio writers to promote CD, Sony did. And I went to all these meetings and stood up and said, this is cannot be allowed to stand. This sounds terrible. I wasn't making any money doing that. I felt I had this need to do it.
You felt it was your mission.
Yes, yeah. I did. And if it hadn't succeeded, I would be on the street living homeless today. But it worked out because I knew I was right, and I wasn't the only person who knew this, but I was one of them, and I, you know, was pretty loud about it. So.
Yeah, and to be fair, the first generation CD players that had a 14-bit instead of 16-bit resolution were truly terrible. You were right in saying that it eventually got better, but sure. at least the first generations were truly atrocious. Yeah.
And the reissues that were coming out were terrible sounding. Everything that I listened to as a reissue on CD sounded not nearly as good as an original record. And that also drove me. And all these people were coming into record stores and dropping off their vinyl and, you know, buying the CDs. And I was like, good, I'll buy those records. And nobody wanted them. And they were $1 a piece. And I loaded up. I was so happy.
Okay.
So in one of your videos, you talked about the time when the late Quincy Jones asked you to testify in court against the Michael Jackson estate for the remastering of his Thriller and Off the Wall albums. And you did it in a very peculiar way. Can you remind your audience?
Sure.
What happened then?
Sure. Well, first of all, of course, the video is up on the Tracking Angle YouTube channel, so you should watch that, because I really go into complete detail. But basically, I was hired by an attorney, not by Quincy himself, by Quincy's attorney, who was a longtime reader of what I had written, and he's still around. He's a lawyer in Texas, and he called me and he said, Michael, I've been reading you for 20, 30 years, and Quincy Jones is about to sue the estate of Michael Jackson and over some issues involving the master tapes of those records that he produced. And I can't think of anyone better than you to do this. And I want to hire you to do that. So I said, okay. And the issue was simply that it wasn't just the remasters of Bad and the other records that Quincy produced. Quincy Jones had the right of first refusal of any reuse of the masters. And even though Michael Jackson's estate owned the masters. And so there were a number of issues involved that there were a bunch of different people, experts hired. But my job was to go into the court and explain to the jury why the remasters of those records, even though they weren't remixes, they were just remasters, why the remasters were so bad that they essentially were remixes, even though they weren't remixed. And so, and this is an idea that I came up with. It wasn't originally why I was brought in there. I was brought in there to talk about a few other peripheral issues that I won't talk about because it's not that interesting, I don't think. So I convinced the attorneys, and the attorneys convinced the judge to allow me to bring a stereo system into the courtroom, which we did, and play for the jury the original mix and the original CD of Bad that had all the dynamic range that was on the recording. It was a digital recording. It was a Mitsubishi X800, I believe, digital recording, a digital mix. And it sounded really great on vinyl, and it sounded really great on the original CD. It had full dynamic range. And because the engineer, Bruce Swedien, was a stickler for imaging and sound staging, he recorded everything using Bloomline pair microphones, you know, cross pairs of microphones that delivered all the three-dimensionality that were in the recordings. And you could hear that on those original CDs and on the original records. It was a wonderful, wonderful sound. And he worked very hard to get it. And Michael Jackson was all in on it. And so if you listen to the original Bad, as Michael gets closer and moves away from the microphone, you can hear him moving in three-dimensional space. Yeah. And when he sings the background, he sings all the background choruses, I'm bad, I'm bad. And you can hear, it's supposed to be women, I guess, but you can hear them lined up in three-dimensional space on either side of his vocal. And so they allowed me to bring the microphones in. And there's a whole dramatic story where the night before we did our last rehearsal, and the psychologist in they were sitting in, the psychologist from the group and the expert witness expert, the guy who was an expert witness on expert witnesses. The process was amazing. And so after the last rehearsal, the psychologist says, I don't think we should play the music. I don't think the jury, which is mostly young people in their 20s, I don't think they're going to hear any difference. It's pretty subtle. And we're going to lose. And so I said, look, you're paying me, and the money was stupidly good. But I would do this, and if you don't want to do it, whatever you want, you know. And then the guy that hired me walks into the room, and he goes, so, Michael, how's it going? And the psychologist says to the lawyer, Mike, his name was Mike also, Mike, I don't think we should play the music. I don't think these young people are going to hear it, and I think we're going to take a big chance and lose this part of the suit. And so he looks at me and he goes, well, Michael, I've trusted you and believed in you for all these years. What do you think? And I said, I think they're going to hear it. I think it's really obvious. He goes, okay, we're going to do it. And the psychologist looks at me and goes, and then Mike says, okay, you go back to your hotel room, get a good night's sleep, and we'll see you in the morning. So I went back and I slept like a baby, honestly. You know, I peed in my bed. Okay, no, I didn't. So, so the next day, I went, and I didn't get a chance to. I didn't know where the speakers were located. I didn't get a chance to hear how it sounded. I knew nothing because they wouldn't let me. They wouldn't let the way the system worked. You're not allowed into the courtroom until the actual trial.
So you couldn't set up the system yourself.
No, no. Okay. But so the way it was, we had a pair of Wilson Sabrinas in there and I forgot what amplifier it was. It may have been a Devi-LA amplifier, and we had the files going directly into the Devi-LA. It limited the variables, but I didn't know what the volume was. So I walk into the court. Oh, before I walk into the courtroom, my attorney says, the judge is in a really bad mood today. Whatever you do, no hemming, no hawing, no, let me think about it. You go in there and you just deliver. Oh, okay. This is making it that much easier for me, you know? And so I walk in, I see one speaker is right behind the defense attorney, you know, who's going to be cross-checking me. She's right behind me. And the other speaker is over by the jury. And I don't know what kind of soundstage we're going to get out of this. And I don't know how loud it's going to be, but this same attorney had deposed me a couple of months earlier because they deposed the witness to get, you know, you have to testify what you're going to say. They have to know what you're going to say to prepare for their defense.
Yeah.
So during the deposition, we're sitting there and my attorney says, remember, no jokes. You're very funny. No jokes. Keep it very serious. I said, okay. So we're sitting there and the witness, the woman that's recording the whole thing says, now remember, this is a deposition. It's not a conversation. So you will have to wait until the attorney finishes asking you the question, no interruptions, and then you answer. Do you understand that? And I said, oh, so this is not like marriage. I get it. Okay. So I got kicked under the table for that. But anyway, so I get into the courtroom. I sit down and I teach the jury what a bloom line pair was. I teach them three-dimensionality. I teach them sound staging. And I say to them, now what's going to happen in the first 3 minutes of this opening song to the album Bad, there's going to be a flourish, bum, bum, bum. And it's Michael Jackson announcing that he's back. Michael Jackson is back. And I look over to the jury and they go, oh, Michael Jackson is back. So I figure, oh, this is going to be good. I got him, you know? And I said, I want you to note each note gets louder than the note before. There's going to be like three notes, but it's going to bomb, bomb, bomb. And it's the last one's going to be much louder than the first one. And that's called dynamics. And the idea is to bring you into it, but to excite you. Okay. And then there's going to be this helicopter sound and it goes beep, 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 beep. And it goes back and forth across the soundstage. The soundstage is the picture that Michael Jackson and Quincy and Bruce Houdin are trying to paint for you to hear. And this helicopter is going to go back and forth right in front of the speakers. It's going to float in front of the speakers. And then I go through the first 3 minutes of the song. Now, did I know that they were going to hear any of that stuff? I did not know, but I was hoping. I said, okay, hit it. And they started. And it was so loud. It was really, it was so loud that the defense attorney fell out of her chair. She literally fell on the floor. It was so good. I so enjoyed that. And I heard, you could hear all of it. And I was absolutely convinced that the jury could hear it. And, you know, those Sabrina speakers could really take a lot of volume and they held up beautifully. So when it was over, I said, okay, now we're going to play the same. Now you're going to hear the same track, but smashed, squashed of all dynamic range, which didn't have to happen. It was done to make it loud and ruin the experience. I think if Michael Jackson was alive, he would not have wanted that at all. So they play it, and you could hear how flat it was. All the dimensionality was cut out of it. Everything was flat up against like a screen, like a TV screen. And the look on their faces was like, whoa, what happened? Anyway, so I went through the whole rest of everything I was supposed to do. And I felt that I really did the job. I felt my brain was talking to my mouth. I didn't waste a word. I didn't have a hesitation. I was like right on. And I got off the stand, and my lawyer said, "You knocked it out of the park." And as I'm walking out, the psychologist who was telling me not to do it looks at me and goes, So I walked out of there. First of all, I said to myself, I would have paid for this experience. Forget about the fact that I was paid to do it. I would have paid for what I learned, you know, from the rehearsals. I learned all about pacing and timing and communicating with the jury. I mean, they taught me all this great communication skills that I would have paid, you know, in a seminar to get. And then I walked out of there. I looked at myself in my phone, and I said, you know, if you could do that, you could do anything now. Nothing's going to ever bother you again. You're under no pressure. And I've lived that way ever since. I'm performing in my life so much better from that experience, because the pressure was really intense, but I managed, you know.
So it was a turning point for you.
In a way. I mean, there were other turning points, you know. If you challenge yourself and get out of your comfort zone, and it works out. I've not always succeeded. I've had some monumental failures that we will not talk about today, but
okay.
You know, but I walked out of there, and it made me enough money to buy my Wilson XVXs. So there, you know, so it was good.
Yeah. Great. And the decision, the final decision were okay.
Oh, that's another funny part of the story. So after my attorney said, go back to your hotel room, have a drink. It was 3 p.m. I said, I don't drink at 3 p.m, but I'll go back to the hotel. He said, I'll call you later and tell you what happened. So he called me later, and he goes, okay, are you seated? I said, yeah. He says, okay, I'll tell you what happened, and don't get upset as I tell you what happened, but here's what happened. So after you got off the stand, the defense attorneys called for a meeting in the judge's chambers. And we went into the judge's chambers, and they said, we'll make a deal with your team. And that is this: we will accede to everything that this witness was brought in to talk about. We will give in. We will not litigate it. Everything that he said, we're not going to challenge. We're going to give in on that, because there were multiple things that were being litigated. So yeah. As far as what he was here to litigate, what he was here to talk about, we give in. We don't want to talk about that anymore. But in exchange for that, his entire testimony has to be stricken from the record. So it cannot be brought up in summation. It can never be talked about again. So that's the deal we made. I said, what? He goes, it's fine. It's as good a thing as could possibly happen in a trial, because first of all, we don't have to litigate it again. We don't have to spend any time dealing with it. We won, you won. And yeah, the jury's not going to hear it in summation, but I promise you that it's like bringing an elephant into the trial and then telling the jury, you never saw an elephant. You know, they will always see that elephant. What you did, you blew their minds, completely blew their minds. And that's why that's why Michael Jackson's team doesn't want to hear about it ever again. So it's all good. So that's what happened. But so, it, you know, in the summation in the Hollywood Reporter the next day, it said, Michael Fremer, witness for Quincy Jones, Michael Fremer, turned the courtroom into jukebox jury and played music. But in the end, his testimony was completely stricken from the record, as if it's because it was bad, but it was the opposite.
Yeah.
So, but Quincy initially won $9 million. And then on appeal, he lost about $6 million or $7 million because the instructions to the jury were incorrect. Juries are supposed to be fact finders. They're supposed to make a judgment about the facts of the case, not about the legal issues. And the attorneys made a mistake in terms of what they said to the jury about what they were supposed to decide. But he still won millions. And yeah. it was one of those experiences that I'll write about in my book that I have to write. You know?
Sure. That's great. Okay. Also, in your videos, we realize that you're an avid record collector. Yeah. How many do you have now?
I must have around 16,000 or so. You know, I've got multiple rooms here that you don't see that are full of records, and I have a storage space offsite that is full of records too. So, you know, I forgot to turn off my messaging thing, so it's going to bleep a little bit. Just forget about that. So.
No worries. So we can imagine that many of these records, especially albums, vinyl albums, were bought by $1 when these people in the 1980s traded them for CDs.
Yeah, you have no idea. Some of the great, I mean, one time, I went to a professor's house at UCLA. This is just when the CD came out, and there was an ad in the classifieds of the local paper. You know, a classical record's $1 a piece, because as far as he was concerned, he's got to get rid of these records before they, you know, cause cancer or whatever he was thinking. So I went to his apartment, and it was $1 a piece, and I was getting, you know, the usual classic, you know, RCAs, Mercurys, British Deccas, all these, you know, I walked out with stacks of records. But that would happen at Aaron's Records on Melrose Avenue too. When CDs first came out, there were so few CDs that they had this glass case at the back of the store where the CDs were. And all these kind of, you know, late tech people would bring in, they'd bring their records in and make a big deal of dropping them on the counter, boom, and go, those are my records, let me buy a CD. And they'd take them to the back, and they'd open up, they'd unlock the key and open the glass doors. It was like going into a temple and seeing the Torah being brought out for the daily read. We open the door, and which CD do you want? And these people would be buying these CDs that I had heard and how terrible they were. And then the records would be stacked up, and I would look through the, you know, I'll take them all. How much are they? And those were the days, let me tell you. And those were the days in LA, because all the record executives were there and they were all getting rid of their records to, you know, switch to CDs. It was fantastic. So, yeah.
Among them, you must have some, among them, you must have some quite rare editions. Do you have them insured?
I have my collection insured, so... Yeah. But don't get any ideas, okay? Don't fly over here. And I have vicious dogs and a moat and an alligator. No, there's a lot of collect. And, you know, the funny thing is, a lot of the records that I thought were $1 records at this point are really valuable in ways I didn't realize. Like I have my genius writer, Malachi, who some of you may know, he's 19, but I met him when he was 12. He called me and he said, do you have a copy of Disintegration by The Cure? And I said, yeah, I've got a promo copy of that. I got one. It's got an 8x10 black and white photo in it. It's got the insert from the record label. I got that. I figured it's a $5 record. I said, I got one. He says, you know, that record's worth $100 now in good shape. I said, what? It's a $100 record now.
Yeah.
So, you know.
It's getting crazy.
It is crazy. And, you know, all the I talk to people at record stores and they're just hungry to get stock, you know, old stock. Can't get them anymore, you know, but so someone's going to get a lot of good records here when I croak, you know. So. I try to show my wife what the good stuff is, but she's not really. I said, here's a copy of an original British Rubber Soul, you know, fold back. British Rubber Soul in mint condition that George Martin signed to me. It's got two Michael from George Martin. I think that'll be collectible, you know. Yeah. No, I don't care. I said, here's the first Queen album, and it's got a handwritten two-page letter to me from Brian May, because I cut the national radio spots for the first three Queen records for Elektra Records. And one day I got this letter in the mail, a 2-page handwritten letter from Brian May thanking me for the commercials, because he said that my commercials, he said, you're the only person that knows how to take our music and edit it down to a minute and make it exciting. And it says, and I was a 22-year-old kid, I guess, when I did those commercials. And he said, we think your music edits are more interesting than ours. I mean, how great is that? So that's in that record. And I said to my wife, let me show you this. She said, no, this is, you know, I'm going to, you're going to outlive me, so it doesn't matter. I can't guarantee that. You know, I fly out of Newark Airport. I'm going to fly out of Newark Airport to Munich to the Hi-Fi show on next Tuesday. Who knows whether the plane's going to take off? Who knows if the air traffic controllers are going to be able to get the instructions? I don't know. Who knows? You know, but
yeah.
But then I won't care. I won't be around anymore, so it doesn't matter. But,
yeah.
Well, we already established that you're not a fan of CDs, but
well, no, that's not. Wait a second, that's pigeonholing me. No, they've gotten much better. They've gotten much better. And like I bought this CD on Discogs. Okay, it's just to show you, I purchased this CD. It's a Don Pullen record called Random Thought. I heard a stream of it. And I really loved it, so I decided I wanted to own it, because here's the thing I've discovered. Streams, even high-resolution streams, don't always sound better than the CDs. Don't ask me why that is, but it's true. Yeah. And if you do a comparison, you might find that yourself. Mm-hmm. So I bought this, and I remember buying a regular CD, but they sent me a Japanese pressing of it, so...
Yeah,
and it was produced by the late Michael Kuskuna, who I knew, and it was recorded by David Baker, a great engineer, and it was recorded at A&R Studios, which was owned by Phil Ramone, great A&R Studios, where Getz Gilberto was recorded, and all these wonderful records were recorded through the years, and it's a digital recording, and it happened to have sounded really good in the stream, so I haven't played this yet because it just showed up yesterday, but I'm gonna put it on my DCS Vivaldi 1 and play it, and I bet you it'll sound good.
Okay.
But when people say to me, take out some of your old CDs that really sounded bad back in the day and play them on your new player, you'll be surprised. So I took them out and I played a bunch. And you know what? I wasn't surprised. They still sounded terrible. But, but good ones can sound very good. And yeah. I'll show you something else. So this is really interesting. This is the Clifford Jordan Quartet. Live at Ethel's. Are you familiar with these Maple Shade records?
No, I'm not.
So these are done by a guy named Pierre Spray, who's passed away. And Pierre, his real business was being a defense analyst, working for the Pentagon. And his side gig was a jazz fanatic who would record all these groups using the purest microphone techniques. And so these recordings came out only on CD because he wasn't going to do vinyl by the 80s when these came out. Vinyl was dying, so he didn't want to do them on vinyl. So they came out on CD, but they were well recorded to tape. So the CDs are out of print and they're very collectible now. And so a label has licensed the titles for vinyl, and the tapes are not, unfortunately, he didn't store the tapes right. And some of the tapes are missing. Some of the tapes were found. So this label,
Is this a Japanese edition?
Yeah, Japanese label. They licensed it. And these are cut from a CD master, really good CD master. And the CD, I have the original CD of this. It's one of the best sounding CDs I've ever heard. Because a guy named Bob Katz did the mastering. He mastered it as well as you could master in those days from tape. And he was very fastidious. He understood what was lost by bad digital mastering. He did really good digital mastering. There was, like it says right on it. Let's see if I can read it here. Minimum miking and minimal length cabling. He mentions the cable brand no mixing board, no filtering, no compression, no equalization, no noise reduction, no multi-tracking or overdubbing. So it's live microphones directly to a 2-track tape recorder. And the record sounds great. Now, does it sound like the CD? Arguably, in some ways it sounds better than the CD. And don't ask me why that is. Whatever goes through, I look at vinyl, you know, cutting lacquers as like another plug-in sort of thing. It adds whatever it does to it. And it's, the record sounds great. So, you know, people are going to enjoy it.
That brings us to another issue, that one beef that you had with MoFi.
Yeah. Want to talk about, you want to open that can of worms? Okay. Get your can opener and open it.
So it could be troublesome.
Okay, so let's go back a little bit in time. So one day I got a record, a MoFi record in called Tony Bennett, I Left My Heart in San Francisco. And I played it and it sounded really odd to me. And I said to myself, this sounds weird, because I have an original pressing. I know the record, and Tony Bennett sings, and there's a reverb behind his voice, and the reverb puts space behind his voice, and you hear the reverb trail off behind his voice, but then you see the three-dimensional picture. And I put this record on, and the reverb is pressed up against his mouth. You know, you don't hear any space. And it was like an odd thing I never heard before. I said, all right, I'm not going to review this record. I'm just going to put it aside. So I put it aside. So over the period of time from, and that was the very first time that MoFi used DSD to record from the tape, because CBS, Sony would not let tapes out of the building. That became their, you know, early on, when vinyl started coming back, they didn't really care about their tapes, because as far as they were concerned, the digital master was the real master, and they didn't really care that much about the tape. So when Bernie Grundman, when Classic Records did Kind of Blue, Sony was happy to send him the original three-track master. So, so Bernie cut lacquers directly from the three-track master tape, adding whatever little bit of reverb he felt he needed to add that was probably added on the original to make it sound like the original. And that tape sat at Bernie's place for like 3 years. I'd go visit Bernie every year because I was in LA, and I'd say, Bernie, the Kind of Blue master tape is still sitting there. What's going on? He goes,
it's still there.
I called them to come pick it up, but they never bother. So it's still sitting here on the floor. And that was also true of the Led Zeppelin master tapes. I'd go into Bernie's and the Led Zepp tapes were sitting on the floor. So where was I? So
some years alone, they don't allow the tapes to
come on. At one point, Mobile Fidelity would go to New York twice a year. They'd bring their Tim DeParavicini machine with them to Battery Studios. The tapes would go out of the vault, come to Battery Studios, and they would sit there and make one-to-one tape copies and then fly home. That's how they did it. Mm-hmm. And at some point, they decide, and they were using one-to-one copies. And I think that's as good as saying it's the original master tape. I don't have a problem with that, because a lot of the records that we think are so wonderful from back in the day were not really cut from the original tape. The original tape was used to produce a cutting master that was equalized for whatever needed to be done to cut a lacquer back in those days. So using a copy of the master is fine. So what happened was, they decided that it was too much of a pain to bring this machine to New York twice a year. So that's how they started doing DSD. And they didn't tell anybody about it, which was a big mistake, of course. The first one they ever did was that record from Tony Bennett. And I heard something weird about it, but I never expected it, that it was cut from a digital source. So then records came out from MoFi, some of which I reviewed and gave good reviews to, and some of which I didn't like. And so I didn't like their double 45 of Love Forever Changes, one of my favorite records of all time. It just didn't sound right to me. And they were very upset with me for that. But I just said, it didn't sound right to me. And the Miles Davis stuff they did sounded great, because the originals were terrible for some reason. The original quintet and quartet records from the 60s were not very good sounding. Everybody knew that something had happened to Sony's, to CBS, to Columbia's mastering chain, that whether it was a switch to solid state or whatever, those records always sounded not so good. So when MoFi redid them, they were actually better. And I wrote that. And I was always honest about what I wrote. If it sounded good, I said it. If it didn't sound good, I said it didn't sound good. And I didn't know that a lot of these were digital masters. Not all of them were. Like the Elvis Costellos were analog masters, and I thought those all sounded great. So then the scandal happened, and how that the whole story behind that is very annoying. And I won't tell it because it involved a journalist from the Washington Post that threw me under the bus. But anyway, so then all my enemies start saying, Fremmer says, Fremmer couldn't hear the difference. Fremmer didn't hear the difference. See, digital's perfect. It went on and on. And it was so annoying because as far as I was concerned, I just heard records that didn't sound good. And I said when it didn't sound good. And was it because of the digital? I don't know. I don't know. But most of them didn't sound that good. And the few that did sound good sounded better than the original all analogs because the mastering was bad to begin with. And, you know, MuFi should have announced it right away, and they didn't. I became the fall guy, and I became the enemy. We've worked all that out now because it wasn't fair to me, for sure. And I originally, when I heard the rumor that it was from digital, I didn't spread. I'm a journalist. I don't spread rumors. I need to get facts. And I got in touch with MoFi and I said, you know, there's a rumor out there that these records are cut from digital files. And if it's true, you better get on top of it because it'll create a big scandal. Get on top of it. And they didn't. And somebody else revealed it on a YouTube channel based on a rumor. And then all of a sudden, oh, Fremmer knew, but he didn't say. You know why he didn't say? Because Fremmer's on the MoFi gravy train. He gets all those records for free, so he wasn't going to talk about it. He's corrupt. I swear to God, that's what was being said.
Yeah. That's a shame.
When it was the opposite. You know, I wouldn't say anything because I didn't know it was true. And sure. I don't like rumors, you know. So.
Okay. But...
You're sorry you asked, right? You're sorry you asked.
No. I think it was a great opportunity to clarify that and
there's more to the story, but I won't tell you. You want to hear another funny story?
Yeah, of course.
Which I've told you. It's a funny story. So when Paul McCartney's album Flaming Pie came out, you know that record Flaming Pie?
Yeah.
It's one of Paul McCartney's records. So it came out in 1990 something, and at that point vinyl was so dead that the American record label didn't release it on vinyl. But Paul wanted 100 copies on vinyl to distribute to his friends. So the mastering engineer was Greg Calabi, who I'm sure many people watching this know. So Greg's a friend of mine, and there's a very funny story involving Greg and early CDs that I'll tell next time I talk to you. But Greg called me and said, you know, Paul wants 100 copies on vinyl. What's the best pressing plant to do this? And this is the mid-90s. And RTI at that point was clearly the best, the only great pressing plant that there was in America. So I said, RTI should do this. And he said, well, okay, but they're in California. And, you know, Paul is very, he's paranoid about bootlegging because a lot of stuff's been bootlegged. And so, well, let me get back to you. So they get back to me and he says, all right, Paul's people, they want all of your credits because whoever's going to do this is going to have to, we'll cut the lacquer and someone's going to have to hand carry the lacquer to California. They're going to have to watch it being plated. They're going to have to watch 100 copies being pressed. And then they're going to have to witness the destruction of the metal parts. So no bootlegging takes place. And I said, fine, I'll be happy to do that, and I'm an honest guy, and I will make sure only 100 copies get pressed, and here's my resume. So I give them my resume. At that point was pretty good, you know. I had Tron under my belt, I had Animal Olympics, I had all of my credits, which were pretty good at that point. And I get a message back, you don't pass, they don't want to use you. So I think what it was they saw that I was a big record collector, and they figured, well, he's a big record collector. Oh. What is he going to do? Okay. So what happened? And now I can tell the story. It doesn't matter. So what happened was I didn't do it, and they brought the guy that at that point Greg had left Sterling Sound. He was at Master Disc. Now he's back at Sterling, but he was at Master Disc, and he cut the lacquer. And the guy that owned Master Disc flew to California with the metal part, with the lacquer, you know, watched it being turned into records, et cetera, et cetera. And then about 2 months later, I get a package in the mail and I open it up And it's a copy of Flaming Pie in a white jacket with a white label and a message from this guy saying, thank you for recommending RTI. We flew out there. It worked out really well. Paul's really happy with his records. And so as a thank you, here's a copy of it. Okay.
Okay.
So I would not have pressed one extra copy, but he pressed a copy. Okay. And then a couple of weeks later, I get another copy from RTI. Thank you. So now I have two copies.
Of this
extremely rare Paul McCartney record that, you know, I don't know how much it will be worth, but probably a lot.
Yeah.
And meantime, I just got notice from someone in California, a guy named Joe Calley. I don't know if you know him. He was involved with Mark Levinson for many years, and he was involved with a company that made graphic equalizers, very well-known graphic equalizers. And now he works with Griffin. He's opening a Griffin store at the Pacific Audio Center, Design Center in California. It's going to be a Griffin. So he called me and he said, I want you to come out and do an event with us at the store. We'll bring play records. We'll bring records. And, you know, I do these events all the time at David Geffen's house. And people come, you know, Bruce Springsteen shows up, Sting shows up, Paul McCartney shows up, and they bring records and they play the records. And, you know, we'll invite you to one of these events and you can come play records. So I'm thinking I would love to do that, of course. And my nephew goes to those too, because that's a whole nother story I won't get into. But if I go to that event and play records at David Geffen's house and Paul McCartney is going to be there. I'll bring one of these white unsigned things, and I'll say, Paul, would you sign this for me? I'll tell you what happened, and we'll play a track from it, and I'll tell the story to the assembled people. How cool will that be?
Getting a little bit of a rewind, we were talking before this about the CDs, and okay, you still give the CDs your approval if the CD it's a good CD, not just because it is a CD versus a vinyl record, obviously. Yeah, but the thing is, back in the 80s, many people said, I think it was the consensus of the market at the time, that the CD would just kill the vinyl. The truth is, vinyl, yeah, that there was a big fall in sales at some years. I would imagine almost zero, but it not only never died, but currently is outselling CDs, and CDs are dying. So
yeah,
why do you think this happened, and how do you think this happened?
It happened for every reason I said it would happen. So this is the best thing. You know, this is the most fun, and I have the paper trail of, you know, I wrote an article in a local LA.
You have the receipts.
I certainly do. I wrote an article in the local LA music magazine called Music Connection. I said the coming digital disaster, and I explained what was going to happen, and I said soon. No one will have CDs and everyone will have records. It didn't happen soon, but it happened. But, you know, the first thing is cassettes killed vinyl. That's the first thing to realize, that vinyl sales cratered as cassette sales rose. And cassette sales rose because people wanted to take their music with them in the car, and they wanted to take the music with them on the Walkman, which was, of course, one of the most brilliant devices ever invented by anybody. You know, a little box that would play a cassette without speakers. You plug in your headphones and away you go. I mean, that was a brilliant idea from someone at Sony. So cassette sales peaked and vinyl sales went down. And the vinyl was getting bad. The pressings were getting bad. The jackets were getting cheapened. The record business always does that. And they wanted something new. And that's what killed the cassettes, killed vinyl. And then the CD was like the final stab of the heart. But, you know, when you look at a CD, it there's very little about its physicality that's attractive. It's a little plastic case, and they could call it a jewel box and make it like into a jewel, but it's not, there's nothing jewel about it. It's just like a data dump. you know, it was, this is when, you know, floppy disks were coming out, and it was, the data is stored as bits, ones and zeros. And the funny thing about this, it's not even digital. You know, a CD is not really digital. It's an analog of digital. So it's a physical representation of the bits. You know, it's not the bits themselves. It's the land and the divots in the disk that are physical representation of the bits. And the laser beam is reading the land and the pit and deciding which is which, what that represents. And so this is an analog of digital. It's like the stupidest system ever. I mean, it's genius, but it's stupid. So I never liked it for conceptually. I don't like the packaging. I never liked it was always fun to put a record on a turntable and watch it spin and watch it, you know, move and make this music. And how the heck does this beautiful music come out of a black record with grooves in it? How does a symphony orchestra come out of it? And then you'd play a symphony orchestra on this, and it never sounded as good to me. It was more dynamic. Yes, it had certain benefits, no noise. But the noise issue is the biggest bogus thing. I mean, I go to the symphony, and when I used to go to, I had a subscription to the symphony in New York Philharmonic. I had a really good seat, and you'd sit down, and you could pay attention to the symphony, or you could pay attention to all the elderly people sitting all around you. People would have a stroke. They'd be dragging them out. You know, the ambulance would come in. But you didn't care what was happening around you because you were paying attention to what was happening on the stage. You know, if you want to pay attention to that, you never enjoy the concert. So if you play a record and there's a pop or a click, everyone's people say, oh, I can't take a pop or a click. Give me a break, you know. But a clean record doesn't have pops and clicks either. Now, a scratch where every, you know, where it's, you know, every turn, can't take that, you know. But otherwise, come on.
Okay, so. But right now it does seem that CD is getting like a slight comeback.
Yes, because physical,
because streaming physical sucks. Yeah.
No, I like streaming. I stream. I like streaming is great for a number of reasons. It's convenient. It's a great tool to use when you're reviewing to be able to pick, you know, make a change and then play the same track on the stream. And streaming can sound great too. And you can find new music to buy. It's like the best 24-hour record store is streaming. But there's something about owning the physical media, because a lot of people are discovering with streaming, they stream, they find something they like, they save it as a favorite, then they go back to play it and it's a different mix or it's a different version. It's not what they wanted because somebody's changed it or the license has been revoked, so it doesn't exist anymore. And they realize that all of this streaming stuff is very transitory. Whereas if they own this thing here, they own it. They have it. They can play it whenever they want. And that's something that's great.
So we already established that you do listen to streaming. Do you have a favorite streaming service?
I like Qobuz. That's what I listen to. My genius 19-year-old writer tells me that I'm stuck in the ghetto with the old people in Qobuz, and that Apple Music is the only thing to listen to. You know, he's. I don't know why I take this abuse. I must like being abused because he abuses me all the time, but I love it. But he's an Apple Music person, and I like Qobuz. And he says, half the great stuff isn't on Qobuz. Everything I like is on Qobuz. A lot of the stuff he likes that I don't like is probably only on Apple Music, but you know. But that's okay. And I say to him, you know, the bottom line is I have more records here to listen to than I'll ever be able to listen to in my life. And I have more new records that people send me. And I buy a lot of records. I mean, you know, I'm not on the gravy train. I bought this record. I buy a lot of records. I said, I can't keep up with the records. You know, I can't be listening to all this stuff on streaming. You know, I'm not stuck in any ghetto. I said, so you're talking to the wrong person about, you know, needing to stream some more, you know. I made a gross analogy to him that I will not repeat to you, but it has to do with proctologists. Okay, so
right.
It was very
Michael. Funny. Surely you have reviewed tons of hi-fi gear during all these years.
Yeah.
So is there a top three of audio equipment that left an indelible mark on you?
You mean when something fell on me? Because a number of pieces have fallen on me. I can show you the scar. No, okay, so, well, you know, I just finished reviewing, and it's right over there, the D'Agostino reference preamp, the Relentless preamp. And how I got that to review is another interesting story, if you have a couple of minutes for that, how I got it. So every year I roast somebody at the LA and Orange County Audio Society, and they give out a Founders Award, and my job is to make the event interesting, because otherwise it's the most boring. It's deadly. There's nobody entertaining, but I can be entertaining. So I roast people. So I roasted Chad Kasem 1 year, and that video is on YouTube. And I suggest you watch that if you're a fan of Analog Productions and what Chad does, because I roast him really, really funny. And I compare him to Moses floating down the Mississippi River in a wreath made out of clarinet reeds. And so my job this year was to roast Dan D'Agostino. So, you know what Dan's products look like with the big, big clock on the front and everything. So I was going to go as Dan's brother, Dan D'Agostino, and Dan's from upstate New York. And upstate New York, they talk like that. They've got this real strong A in their accent, and it's a whole way of talking. It's very different than you know, I normally talk, and you probably never heard anybody that talks that way, but that's upstate New York. So I was going to go as his brother, Dan, and I was going to tell all these stories about Dan growing up in upstate New York and how he was weaned. He was born in a snowdrift outside of Buffalo, New York, and how he was weaned on hot red sauce and Enfamil. And it was a funny story. And I was going to wear this big clock, Flava Flav clock. And anyway, he found out about it and didn't like this at all. And he said, and his representative said, if you do that, he's going to walk out on you. He's just going to get up and walk out. And we had the biggest audience. He had the biggest crowd because, you know, Dan's been in this business, you know, with Krell and now D'Agostino. He's like a legend for good reason. And we had over 300 people coming to this event. It's the largest attended one of these galas they ever had. I came in second, which was amazing to me because I'm not even part of the industry really. But so he came in first and I said, okay, we can't do that. And so the guy that runs the event said, okay, don't do that, but bring all the props and get up and say, well, I was going to do this, but Dan didn't like that. I was going to wear that. I had this half-bald wig, but Dan did. So I did that. And then I made all the jokes I was going to make, and it was very funny. And he kind of steamed. Yeah, he wasn't. I could tell he was only moderately happy, but then I told a couple of really funny things that he had to laugh at. And then I got very serious and I got very sincere. I got more sincere than I thought I had in me. I mean, I don't know what it was. Something about that event and all of what he's been through, the whole thing brought my sincerity to a level I didn't think I had in me, because I'm not that empathetic a person. I'd like to be, but my upbringing and what I went through as a kid makes me not as empathetic as I should be. But I was at that point. And I really got into his problems and what he went through. And I could see it really touched him and it touched the audience. And I got off of there and I just felt really good about it. And he was really happy about it. And then Bill McKeegan, who works with him, came up to me and said, you know, Dan was really touched by that. Do you want to get one of the Relentless, someone just to listen to? So I said, okay, why not? Who wouldn't want to listen to that? And the Absolute Sound did not have that to review, because the review of the big amplifiers wasn't that positive and they were afraid to give it to somebody at the Absolute Sound. So he let me have it, take it home and listen to it. And that is one product I will say is one of the, because I have a really good preamp. I've listened to a lot of great preamps, and I own the Dart Seal, which is a very good preamp. And I reviewed a bunch of other top shelf preamps, and it's always a trade-off, you know, better in this way, not as good in that way. This characteristic that, you know, it's always, this piece to me is better than anything I've ever heard. It made records that I thought I knew really well. I didn't know them that well. I heard into the stage. It was so quiet. I heard into the stage. I heard things. You know, I have that direct-to-disc Berlin Philharmonic recording of Bruckner's Seventh Symphony that they put out. and I had written some notes for that, and I had to listen to that record a lot to write anything about it. And the idea that the Berlin Philharmonic would hire me to do anything in classical music was like, forget about it. But I did, and it was mostly about the sound of the recording. But I wanted to get a little bit in there about the music, because I don't want to be just seen as some tech guy. So I listened to the music really seriously, and I got to know that piece very well. And I thought I knew everything about it. And I, when I reviewed that piece, I criticized some aspects of the recording. But when I played it back on this preamp, I realized my criticisms were of my equipment, not of the recording.
Not of the recording. Okay.
That happens a lot. And that happens a lot to everybody that reviews, because you think your system is so good that if you hear something that's not good, you criticize the recording, and really maybe it's your system that needs some uptake. But anyway, yeah. I listened to it and I reviewed it for the Absolute Sound. It's in the current issue. And that piece I hate to use the word game changer. I hate when I hear that, it makes me vomit. But it's not a game changer. You know what's a game changer? When there's a football game and somebody kicks a goal and wins a game, that's a game changer. This is just a piece of equipment. I hate that. I hate cutting edge. I hate all these cliches that you see online from the influencers who know nothing and act like they know everything. I hate these guys. I listen to 1,000 turntables and here's what I think. He never listened to 1,000 turntables. I went on that guy's website and I said, why not say you listen to 1,000,000 turntables? Why not just completely make a fool of yourself? 1,000 turntables. It just makes me crazy. Yeah. Anyway, that was a game-changing piece. The OMA K3 turntable that I reviewed a couple of years ago and bought was the first direct drive turntable I ever thought about buying, and I bought it. That was a game change. That was a really good piece.
Yeah, and we get it.
And then I sold that, and I bought the GMT, the Wilson Benesch GMT, which is by far and easily the best turntable I've ever heard. I can't say it's the best turntable in the world. I never write that kind of stuff. I hate that. This is the best in the world. I don't know. This is the best that I've heard. And the direct drive it's an amazing piece of work. That's all I can say. And there were things about the OMA, the speed correct performance was really amazing, because it really had, you know, what people like about idler wheel drives, that sense of relentless perfection of rhythm and pace. It had that, but it had much less noise than I hear from idler drives. But there was something about it that bothered me, and I never solved that problem. And I said, okay, the rest of it's so great, I can live with this other thing. And then when I reviewed the Wilson Benesch, was in the same room with the OMA, and I compared them, I heard what it was. It was the quiet in the background. This turntable is so quiet. It gives you a sense of relaxation that I never got from the other one, as good as it was. It was noise, some form of noise that they surmise has to do with the bearing, which uses a material that will never wear out, that will never have a problem, never needs lubrication. But I think there's a noise generator. I'm only surmising that. This is so quiet. And there's a video I made of Babylon Sisters from the Analog Productions UHQR of Gaucho that has over 151,000 views. Over 151,000 people have listened to it, even though it's that turntable through the meat grinder that is YouTube's algorithm, you know, what YouTube does to audio. Even through that, you can hear this. And people, usually when you put up stuff like an expensive product in a YouTube video, they go, you're just a selfish son of a gun. You know, you could feed half of Sub-Sahara Africa for what you paid for that piece of gear, blah, blah, blah. You know, you get that kind of stuff. And with this, it was like, wow, I know that. I've never heard it sound like. I hear it. Oh, my God. You know, and then there were always the trolls.
Even through YouTube.
Even you go listen to it. You can hear it. Even through YouTube. This turntable to me is hopefully this will be the last one. And the way I got to own this turntable, which is stupidly expensive, is another great story, because things happened at the right time for me. You know, so my nephew was the CEO of Activision Blizzard, the video game company, you know, Call of Duty and Guitar Hero. That's my sister's son. And so when he started Activision, I was buying stock. And of course, I was also giving him my good advice, which was, Bobby, video games are a fad. I would suggest you think about doing something else. You can't be right about everything, you know? And so So I had the stock, and then when he sold it to Microsoft for like $60 billion, a nice amount of money showed up. Just showed up. Enough money showed up for me to buy this turntable. So my accountant said, "Just buy it. What are you worried about? You know, if you got to sell it because you're desperate for money, you can sell it. But it plays music a lot better than looking at a picture of money in the bank. You know, so." So I've been very lucky. I've been very lucky about a lot of things, you know. And the other thing I'm very lucky about is when I was a little kid, I didn't reach puberty till I was like 19 years old. And let me tell you something. When you're in a college dormitory in the communal bathroom and you're 18 years old and you look like a fetus, it's really painful. It's really painful. It was a terrible period of my life. And I kept telling myself, on the other side of this, when you get really old, you're going to look young, and that'll be the payback. And if that doesn't happen, you'll just kill yourself. But that's kind of happened. So, you know, I'm really happy. Everything's good.
So you also had some adventure in producing some albums.
Yeah, that's another adventure. So so I was at a small concert with a friend of mine. We have a friend who was a concert promoter for jazz. And when COVID hit, of course, that was the end of his career. There was no concerts to promote. And then when COVID was lifting, he decided to run a very small concert series at a piano showroom in Manhattan. So it's basically a showroom. And they have a nice Fazioli piano and seating for about 40 to 50 people and lighting and a sound system. And he ran what's called the New York City Jazz Piano Marathon. And so we decided to go in and support our friends. So we went one day and we sat there and a few people, young people played and they were good. And then all of a sudden the bassist Rufus Reed came in, very well known jazz bassist, who was also a professor and a mentor. And he came in and set up his bass. And then the promoter announced, now, Rufus, I said to Rufus, "Who's the new cat? Who's someone who we should know about?" And here's Rufus and Kalen Cardello. And so Kalen Cardello, this young man in his early 20s, sits down and they start playing. And it was after the second track, I said to my friend, this is like a young Bill Evans. Not that he sounds like Bill Evans, but just lyrical like Bill Evans, all the qualities that people love about Bill Evans, this mm-hmm. young man has got it. It's just too bad this wasn't being recorded because this is good enough to release. And my friend said, "Look more carefully. There are microphones all over the place." And a friend of ours, Duke Marcos, is recording this to six tracks of 9624 digital. So it's being recorded. So when it was over, and the whole concert was magical. And as it turned out, they had never played together before. Duke had followed Kalen around. Rufus had followed Kalen around New York City, watching him perform. And, you know, he was at Juilliard. He was, you know, in school. And decided this was a good opportunity for the two of them to play together. So he invited him to play. They sat down a half an hour before the concert and picked a bunch of tunes they both knew. And that's what you heard. First time they played together. It was magic, you know? And so I said to myself, I'm not going to walk out of here and say, I should have said something. I should have done something. I'm just going to do it. And I went over to Rufus and I said, "Rufus, if this sounds as good as I think it does in the recording, can I put this out on vinyl?" And he said, "If you pay me, yeah." So I said, "All right, let's work this out." So I got a rough mix and it was great. And the performance was as good as I thought it was. And Kalen was happy. We said, "Look, we'll take a chance. We'll put the money in to put this thing out. And in exchange for you, we'll give you like 500 CDs that you could sell for $20 a piece at your shows. You have no recordings out." So he agreed to that. So we did the mix. It sounded great. I got Joe Harley, the tone poet, involved in helping to place the instruments on the stage. He had some very good input. And then we were ready to master it. And I was going to have it mastered at... out at Chad Kasem's place by Matthew Luthans on the Doug Sachs's The Mastering Lab mastering system, because I thought that would be a perfect thing for a 9624 a digital recording, which sounded great. Okay. And Bob Ludwig was about to retire at that point. And so I said, you know, I'm just going to send this to Bob as a gift, because he's done so much great stuff, and you know, I've known him over the years. So I sent him the files, and I said, Bob, I just want you to have this. I think this kid's a really great musician, and I think he's going to go places, and I want you to have this, have the files before we make the record. And next day he got back to me and said, you know what? I'm retiring, but I want to master this for you. I want this to be one of my last projects, because I think in 5 years, everyone's going to know this kid. And he mastered it. And what he did to it, I can't tell you what he did. It's like if you go to a restaurant and have a really good meal from a great chef, you shouldn't be able to say, oh, it was that spice and that spice and that spice. You should just know it's a great meal and it tastes great, whatever was in there. So Bob sent it back, and it was better than what we sent him. Not remarkably so, but better. And his name is on it. And I said to my partner in this project, I said, we didn't do it for the money. We both said, if we lose money, we're okay. We're doing this because we think this people should know about this. And if they don't like it now, they'll like it eventually. If nobody hears about it, whatever. So he agreed. And we had a pretty, adding Bob to the budget was, you know, something. So we pressed 2,000 copies and we sold every copy, and people loved the record and we made money. And Kalen's happy, and Kalen has a record out. And now he's got a second record out that we're working on. And I hear from people all the time. They bought that record and they love it, and they thank me for putting it out. And then I did a record with Patrick Leonard that's out now, which is also a great record. And Patrick Leonard, of course, everybody knows Patrick Leonard, even if they don't think they know Patrick Leonard, because he produced all the early Madonna records. He wrote a lot of the songs for Madonna. Co-wrote the songs, produced those records. It was in a band called Toy Matinee. He produced Amused to Death for Roger Waters, did work with Pink Floyd, did work with David Gilmour, helped produce the last three Leonard Cohen records, wrote some of the great songs on those records. So he's got now it's a year old, but he put a record out called It All Comes Down to Mood, which was something Leonard Cohen once said to him, you know, Patrick, it all comes down to mood. And, Patrick came to me to produce the vinyl version of the record, which I did, which is another great experience to have. And that happened because Patrick said to Bob, I want to put this on vinyl. What should I do? And Bob said to call me. So if you had said to me even 10 years ago, well, Bob Ludwig's going to recommend you over himself to produce a vinyl record for a well-known artist, I wouldn't have believed it, you know? So yeah, I'm having a great time. What's not to like, you know?
That's great.
Although I have my enemies are out there. You know, the enemies are like, I saw you in that video. You're looking kind of frail. You know, watch yourself. So I say to that guy, I say, you know what? Obviously, you want to die young. So why don't you just go have at it? You know.
Yeah.
Crap from people.
So Michael, we're nearly finishing our interview. Our time is finishing, so we're gonna ask you the last question that we ask to everyone that we interview. What music doesn't come out of your head lately?
Okay, I'll make it a quiz. For some reason, I'll hum it for you, and you'll tell me what it is. And if you don't know it, you'll have to look it up. It's a jazz piece that goes da 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 bum bum da 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 bum da 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 bum bum.
Miles Davis.
That's the jazz piece that runs through my mind.
Yeah. Okay.
It's true. That started happening about 2 days ago, and I don't know why. I don't think I've played it in a while. I don't think I've heard it in a while. But the other record that's I can't hum it, but I got this Lost, you know, the Lost Tapes series?
Yeah.
So there's one by Alicia LaRocca, you know, the classical pianist. And I've been listening to a lot of her records. I have a lot of her records, you know, Spanish classical music. And I really like those records. A lot of them are on Decca London, and they just released one that was recorded in East Berlin in the late 60s in stereo. And the program was really, really good. And so I bought it. I wasn't on their gravy train. I bought it. And it's just, I've been playing that a lot. It's a beautiful recording. You know, it's digitized analog because that's the best way they could take these old tapes and make sure that they work. And they sent the files to Kevin Gray. He cut them, and the pressing is really beautiful. And and you know, there's another record, and I can't remember her name, which is really stupid. But when I came to Lisbon, I brought this woman's record with me. I went to a record store. I'd have to get up and get it over there. I went to a record store in New York, and there was not one record I knew in the store. And so I said to the person who owned the store, I said, pick three records out for me that I should listen to that I don't know. And he picked three records out. And one of them was this Turkish disco record, which is actually kind of cool. And one was this very well-known Portuguese singer. I can't remember her name, unfortunately. And it was a Portuguese EMI pressing, but it's from the 60s. And I know where it is, but you know, before we finish, I'll get up and get it. And you can edit it, right? So I'll get it. But I brought it with me, and not knowing what it was, I liked it a lot. It's a kind of folky music, and beautifully recorded, and her voice is amazing. But for all I knew, I'd get there and they'd go, "Oh, this she's like the Portuguese Liberace." I mean, I don't know, but I took the record out, and they went, "Oh my God, you have this record? Oh, you know who this is? Oh, she's like." It was really cool to find that out. Yeah, right. Carmen Miranda. This woman did not have bananas on her head. Okay, wait a second. I'm gonna get up, and I'm gonna go find this record for 2 seconds. If I can't find it, I'll I gotta carefully slide out of my seat. Amalia Rodriguez.
Oh, it's Amalia.
Oh, it's Amalia.
She was like the goddess of Fado.
Okay, you should get another record from her. I'll show you this one.
Is this good? This is a good one though, right?
Yeah, that's a good one. But I'll show you another one.
Okay.
It's unexpected.
I want everyone at home to see that I found my record a lot more easily than he found.
Yeah, that's
okay.
True.
So, Amalia is a Fado artist, singer. Did you know that?
What's that?
Michael. Amalia Rodrigues, yeah. It's a Fado singer here in Portugal.
That's type of music?
Yes, Fado.
The type of music. It's Fado. Yes. Yeah.
Fado.
It's a very traditional way of singing here in Portugal. So, Amalia in 72, 73 maybe, she record this one that it's called Encontros. Encontro.
How do you spell that?
It's like this. Oh. Encontro.
Encontro. Oh, encounter, meeting, right?
Yeah. Encounter, meeting. Yes. Yeah. And at the time, it was a very controversial album because what she did. She invited Don Bias, you know, the saxophonist, Don Bias.
Yes, Don Bias.
To play with her.
Oh.
Yeah, to play with her. Yeah.
Wow.
Because this kind of music traditionally is accompanied by Portuguese guitar.
Right.
Which is a special kind of guitar.
Guitar with 12 strings and the sound. Just is
a special tuning, etc.
Yeah. So. At the time, it was a very controversial this one because, everyone was saying that Amalia was not respecting the tradition of Fado music. But at the end, this is a beautiful record. You should try to listen to it.
Yeah, I will.
It's very.
I'll stream it first and see if I like it. I'm sure I'll like it.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll find a copy.
All right. All right, so Michael, thank you so much for having us.
It was fun.
Yeah, it was fun.
Yeah, it was fun for us too, Michael. Thanks very much for your time.
Sure. And when you put this up, let me know when it's live, and I'll try to.
We'll send you the link.
Of course.
Okay.
When it's online. Yeah. Okay. Sure.
Okay,
so,
guys.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.